Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well.
I'm glad to
hear
it.
Very well.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, today we're going to continue our series called Skirting the Rules. And
you mean our lifelong series, you and me?
No, I mean just on the radio show.
Oh, okay.
We've come across a bunch of pieces where a bunch of articles recently where the rules on food and wine have come into question.
Well, there are some good rules in the world about food and wine, and there are some less good rules about food and wine.
One of the rules is, of course, that you can't have, in many states and in most states, you can't have unpasteurized milk. Now, we think that's a bad rule. I think that unpasteurized milk should be regulated, but...
And very well regulated, too. There are some bad things that can happen to unpasteurized milk. The reality is we can test for all of those things.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the big milk lobby doesn't want you to be able to do that, and their corporate toadies keep that from happening because their corporate toadies are in the various state departments of agriculture, and it's you know, these small family farmers run very clean farms that serve milk the way it was served for 7,000 years.
And again, if they don't, I'm not saying every small family farmer is going to do that, but let's regulate that. Let's test for the pathogens and the bad things that can be in the milk, and then let's move on and be able to offer people a choice.
I mean, you know, most of the world, including the first world, allows unpasteurized milk. You know, in Ireland, you can get your hands on unpasteurized milk.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and many of the great cheeses of the world come from unpasteurized milk.
Yes.
There was a recent lessening in the last few years. There was a lessening of the regulation in the United States that says that milk from unpasteurized cheeses can come to the United States or be sold in the United States, but only if it's been aged for 90 days. Or 60 days. I'm sorry, only if it can be aged for 60 days. And the idea is, well, any pathogens that exist will be killed in 60 days. Well, listen, that means that raw camembert, one of the great pleasures of the world, you can't have. In France, raw camembert is everywhere.
Right.
Savoir-faire is everywhere.
You can't have it here in the United States. You can have it if you go to France.
Exactly. So, but if you make cheese safely and well, and a lot of these quote-unquote health regulations, like when they always try to push for the laws that say your burger has to be done well, has to be well done. Well, whenever you go into a chain, and there are many chains that do this, and they say, oh, you can't get a burger medium rare, it has to be well done. What they're saying to you is, and I always say this to the server, and hopefully it gets back to management. I say, oh, so this restaurant is so dirty and filthy that you can't be sure that a medium rare piece of meat is safe and clean? And they say, well, no, you should never eat medium rare meat. Well, you should never eat medium rare meat that comes...
If it's dirty.
If it's dirty, and what modern agribusiness, these big agribusiness firms want to be able to do is make dirty food and then irradiate it and pasteurize it so it won't make you sick, rather than being clean, which is what a lot of small farmers want to do. Anyway, I'm on my high horse now.
You sure are. Get off.
So young raw cheese is, if you travel the world, some of the most amazing cheeses in the world are young raw cheese.
They really are.
And American cheese farmers can't sell them. Mary and Dave Falk at Love Tree Farmstead in Minnesota have an interesting concept, a way that you can get raw milk young cheese. I don't know if they're trying to circumvent, but in effect they circumvent with their raw sheep's milk cheese. Again, it's Love Tree Farmstead. You can find that online, and we'll link to it on our site. They have a meticulously crafted fish bait. Now, what is he talking about, you might say? See, they can't sell for human consumption...
Unfermented cheese that's under 60 days old. Unpasteurized cheese that's under 60 days old.
So what they do is they make a fish bait, which, of course, is not regulated, and you can have whatever you want in the
fish bait.
Right,
fish can eat anything they want.
And let me tell you something. This fish bait's expensive.
And tasty.
And it looks delicious. So if you want to go to Mary and Dave's Falk's Love Tree Farmstead and order some
fish bait,
it's great. And the Gourmet Magazine had a piece about it. It said, the most interesting and meticulously crafted fish bait we've ever tasted. Well, actually, it's the only fish bait we've ever tasted.
We've probably had squid, calamari, you know, that's fish bait, right?
Yeah, well, all fish is fish bait for another fish, except for, like, the whales and the sharks. Minnesota, also the bastion of
scoff laws.
Skirting the rules. There are some bars that are getting around the smoking restriction in bars because there is a there's an exception, of course, to the no smoking in public places. If you're in a theatrical production, if someone on stage has to smoke as part of the production, that's allowed. Well, Minnesota bars are having theater nights.
I think it's hysterical.
And you come and you pay a dollar to join the theater troupe. And you play the role. Your role is, it's a free form art form, and you play the role of a bar patron smoking. Well, anyway, this thing is really taking off.
We are a creative nation, okay? We are a nation of really creative people who want what we want, and we're willing to do almost anything to get it.
Well, this is taking off, actually, and you wear a little button, and what's happened, those people have really taken it to heart, and now people are coming in costumes, people are speaking in strange accents to each other all night long, and they're actually engaging in some wacky performance art of their own making. So this begs the question, what is theater? And the Minnesota Health Department doesn't know quite what to do about it, but I'll tell you something, there's a downside to this. Mm-hmm. We have three theaters next door.
I think what the Minnesota bars and bar patrons are doing is more showing us what is a scoff law,
yeah,
as opposed
yeah.
to what is art.
Well, you know, the interesting downside, and I think it's amusing, and I would let them smoke, but and if you don't like smoking, go to a different bar. Who wants to go to a bar with a bunch of crazy people talking in accents anyway? but the danger here is, you know, I remember when there was Uta Hagen, one of the great stage actresses of all times, was in a performance at this George Street Playhouse next door, and mm-hmm. in her role she had to smoke a cigarette, and that was part of the character that she was playing. It was integral to her role. And I remember one of the patrons sent, because it was shared with us, sent a letter complaining that Uta Hagen was smoking on stage in the theater, and that it was, you know, endangering the health of anyone, it should be banned. Now, that she should pretend to smoke, that if she was such a good actress, she could act like she was smoking.
She was a really good actress.
Yeah, she's about the best of all time. So, you know, I think that we do need to make a distinction, and that a single actor smoking or actors smoking on a stage needs to be protected. And the only thing that I'm afraid of is that Minnesota will come and say, okay, we'll have to close this loophole.
Right.
No one can smoke in an enclosed place, including actors on a stage. And that could be dangerous to the arts.
Well, you know, any time that you circumvent, that you circumvent the law, you create an opening for the law to get more stringent, mm-hmm. for the law to get tighter. I mean, mm-hmm. it happens in the restaurants. You see, we'll have a policy or procedure that says, you know, somebody can have a beer at the end of the night. Well, somebody takes advantage of that and has a $90 beer at the end of the night.
Or has three beers at the end of the night.
Right, or has three beers. And so,
on us without paying.
So what you do is you become more restrictive.
You say no more beers at the end of the night.
In the things that you allow. And so there are problems that can come from this. Although I think both of these things are hysterical.
Well, I have to
add. And I'm gonna order some bait.
I admire. I think the cheese thing is unequivocally great. But I think the Minnesota bar acting thing, very creative. I applaud you guys. Just be very, very careful. But if I were in Minnesota, I'd wear a funny hat, even though I don't smoke, just to go to one of those bars. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Tony Forder. He is one of the co-founders and publishers of the Ale Street News. It's the most circulated beer newspaper in America.
Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
We love the Ale Street News. It, you guys started it, now, what was it, 1992?
Yep, 92. We just celebrated our 15th year last year.
That's the same year we started our first restaurant.
Oh, and, okay. Synchronicity.
Yeah. I first got turned on to the Ale Street News. A guy by the name of Chris at Old Bay in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Boy, his last name escapes me, unfortunately, he passed away last year, I believe. He was sick and had some kind of cancer. And,
wow.
He was a pioneer in beer in New Jersey.
He sure was. He was one of those guys that led the movement.
And he's the guy who turned me on to your magazine. He was so ahead of the curve that, you know, even when the new publication was coming out, and I remember him bringing me the magazine and saying, you got to read this. It's, you know, a magazine that's really focused on beer and all the kinds of things that we're trying to do. And at that time in New Brunswick, you know, had a kind of a beer revival kind of centered around the Old Bay.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was one of our, you know, first big supporters when we came out. You know, there were just a few people really that were in the vanguard. I mean, that's kind of the reason, of craft beer, that is, you know, that's sort of the reason we began the paper, because we saw a lot of these new beers were coming into the stores, onto the shelves, and people didn't really know a lot about them.
Well,
and
let's,
so that gave us the idea to start an educational newspaper.
Well, let's talk about craft beer in America. You know, I remember that, I guess, when I started bartending in 1986, I remember I had an Ankerstein Liberty Ale, and it was one of the few, you know, microbrews that were around that we could get here in New Jersey, and it was like a revelation to me. And it was really one of a number of smaller breweries that have, you know, that we've seen many, many small breweries pop up around America, but at the same time, I think we've seen that large beer houses have tried to jump on the bandwagon of craft beers and pass off some, well, not so craft beers, mm-hmm, as craft beers.
Craftless beers.
Craftless.
Can you talk to us about what really is a craft beer and what might be out there pretending to be a craft beer?
Sure. Yeah, this is something we've seen a couple of times when the craft beer segment heated up in the 90s. A lot of people started jumping in and, you know, looking at a way to make money. And it did kind of dilute the market there. And then there was, you know, it was confusion amongst the consumers and the retailers. And basically there was a, you know, it hit the wall. There was a weeding out. And then things were quiet for a couple of years. And then, you know, the strong craft breweries, really the regional ones that kind of stayed home and did their thing, they grew stronger. And, you know, we've just been seeing a tremendous, you know, growth the last 3 years with you know, craft beer. And now we're seeing again, now it's the larger breweries that are getting interested again and trying to you know, make their own so-called craft brews, which we sometimes refer to as stealth beers, because they don't always carry the brewery's name.
Moniker, sure. You know,
exactly,
whether,
on the label.
You know, Blue Moon or...
But by definition, what is referred to as craft beer is generally an all-malt brewing, which is, means it's a traditional way of making beer with the four ingredients of malt, hops, barley, and water. And yeast, sorry, malt, hops, sorry, malt and barley are the same thing. So it's hops, barley, yeast, and water. And this results in a fuller flavor beer. Now, what the larger breweries do, mainstream beer, is they add brewing adjuncts such as rice or corn, which add fermentables, which can be turned into alcohol, but they do not add any flavor, really.
So let's take, for example, I mean, there are some beers that are actually decent beers. If I'm out at a place that has, you know, my choices on tap are, you know, some very, very mainstream, constricted to mainstream beers, and then there's Sam Adams. I'll order a Sam Adams, but that's not a microbrew.
It is a craft beer. It's not a microbrew, but it is a craft beer. There's a difference. In fact, several of the original pioneering microbreweries, Sierra Nevada is another one.
Sierra Nevada is another one.
Yep, they kind of outgrew the category, which is sort of, to be a microbrewery, is supposed to be less than 50,000 barrels a year. A barrel is 2 kegs, so it's 30,000 kegs. So there's another category now in the craft brewing area called regional craft brewery, which is what Sierra Nevada is, which is what Harpoon is, which is what Brooklyn Brewery is.
So these are breweries that are making a quality product just on a larger scale.
Exactly.
Well, and these are all the breweries you're naming were kind of the first in breweries as far as this whole movement went. You know, Sierra Nevada, Harpoon, even Sam Adams, when these are the were kind of the they were the early innovators. They were the people who came in and kind of created this marketplace.
Exactly.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about brewing that's different than winemaking is that brewing doesn't, you don't need a vineyard in a specific place with a specific kind of weather to make great beer. You can make great beer in a lot of different places, and people are, correct?
Absolutely. You know, historically, breweries used to be built where the water was good. You had Burton in England, and, you know, in the Czech Republic, the water is very important. But with water technology these days, you can really kind of adjust the minerals in the water to what you want, you know, for brewing.
Hey, Tony, we're going to leave that there for 1 second. I want to pick this up on the other side of a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Tony Forder of the L Street News, the largest circulation beer newspaper in the country. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, it's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Tony Forder of L Street News. We're talking about craft beer in America. Now, we talked just before the break about how, you know, brewing beer is less constrained by geography than, say, making great wine or making, a small house wine. Do you deal with, in L Street News, do you think that the homebrew phenomenon helps these professional craft brewers? I mean, do you think people develop more of a taste and an understanding of beer when they make some at home?
Absolutely. In fact, I would say that the home brewing hobby spawned the craft brewing industry. I mean, there's so many people that became brewers that were home brewers before. Even Jack and myself, founding the Ale Street News, we used to make beer together, and that's where we, you know, hatched our plot to come out with a newspaper.
I'm sure you're glad you did.
We definitely are.
Now,
a consumer picking these craft beers up off a shelf, how do they determine because what you said earlier is very true. A lot of these beers that are pretending to be craft beers are kind of under the radar. They're not putting the name Miller on the bottle. How does a consumer picking a bottle off the shelf know if they have a craft brew or just one that's trying to pretend to be?
Well, you know, I mean, I think consumers can really try everything, and ultimately, you know, the taste is going to be their guide. If they like something that may be brewed by a larger brewery, you know, why shouldn't they drink it?
That's true.
Don't buy it again. For example, Anheuser-Busch, they have come out with a line of, some so-called craft beers, and they only list the location of the brewery, like Fairfield, California, or is it Fairfax, California? And if you don't know that AB has a brewery there, then you might not figure out that it's brewed by them.
Mm-hmm.
But they admit that they purposely didn't put Anheuser-Busch on that label because they didn't, you know.
Are they craft beers or are they not craft beers?
Well, that's probably open to interpretation. Ingredient-wise, you know, they may be approaching craft brew, but then, you know, they are brewed at a mega brewery.
Yeah, it's hard to say if you make 100 million cases of something that it's craft brew.
They don't, you know, they're not doing that kind of volume either with these new labels. They're really just, very small volume, minuscule compared with, what they make of the mainstream, you know, Bud Light, that kind of thing.
Well, Tony, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for coming on the show. We're going to talk with your partner at L Street News, Jack Babin, after the news. About a Belgian beer festival that's coming up, and also more about the L Street News. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with the founders of the Ale Street News. Prior to the news, we were talking with Tony Forder, and now we're talking with his partner, Jack Babin.
Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, gentlemen. Happy to be here.
Hey, man, we love your we love the Ale Street News. We talked about it quite a bit with your partner, Tony. Been around since 92. That's the same year we started our first restaurant.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, we have mutual anniversaries coming up. Now,
timing is everything.
Now, you guys have a website at Ale Street News?
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we're very proud of it. It's www.alestreetnews.com. And we're very excited about it because just last week, we launched a completely new generation of our website. It is a screaming edge new. It's got all the features that most people on the web would be looking for. But what it allows us to do is to reach out and connect even further with the people that read Ale Street News, who we call beer ambassadors. They can go to alestreetnews.com, and we encourage everybody to register and become part of us.
Now, what happens when you become part of the Ale Street News? Is there a blog that they can?
There is a blog. There are forums, so we have topics that people can keep up on, and they can keep up on what's going on, favorite trends, tastes, events. Conversely, we can email them and keep them up to date on the latest Ale Street News beer dinner or festivals or whatever's going on. And if they have a topic that they want to post and put up and discuss with others, they can do so as well.
You've got a big event coming up in New York City at on Belgian beer, don't you?
Yeah, Ale Street News, we do hundreds of events across the country, but the one that we do every year, which everybody waits for, is it's coming April 10th, Ultimate Belgian Tasting. And it's just a very, very exciting event, very high-end. We bring world-class beers, particularly the Belgian, the best beers of the world, and we match these, we offer these, present these in combination with Belgian chocolates, Belgian cheese, Belgian waffles. We have some top New York City chefs that get involved.
You better have Belgian fries.
I'll see what I can do.
Now, talk to us about, is this in a restaurant? How does this? How are these presented?
Well,
where do you go?
What we've had in the past is this is the third Ultimate Belgian Tasting, so hopefully we've got the formula right. The first time was at an art museum. Last year was at in the Times Square area at a Heartland. This year it's at the Heartland Brewery within the Empire State Building on 34th and 5th, and people can order tickets online at Ale Street News. We have the entire space, and what it is, it's a very elegant setting as well. And as we say, you know, suggested dress is jacket and tie for men, and women dress as elegantly as you feel. So this is not a frat party. This is not a beer party. This is the highest level presentation on the East Coast of Belgian beers in association with the foods. And also the Belgian consulate gets involved, Belgian Trade Bureau, visitbelgium.com.
Now let's talk about Belgian beer, and just to contextualize for our listeners, Belgian beers are, you know, it's the same sort of, people have said of Belgian beer that it's the same care applied to beer and the same traditions derived from and built around beer that the French place on wine. It's just that you don't really grow very good grapes in Belgium, and so you have grains, and that's where the Belgian beer comes from. We have in our restaurant, I like to age some Belgian beers in the wine for my personal use. Mm-hmm. I age some of these Belgian beers in our wine cellar, and they really do approach wine or match wine in complexity, in longevity. Talk to us about how Belgian beer are different as a category than most other beers.
I'd be happy to. And this is not to minimize in any way, shape, or form the great beers that are being brewed in the United States. But Belgium, as a country, obviously, has been around longer than the United States. Belgium has also been conquered over time by many, many different conquerors and countries. And one of the things that they've brought and left is a series of different brewing styles. So what they do there is, for instance, some of the lambics, which is a beer that is it starts with what they call a goose, which is a very sour, undrinkable beer. These are mixed with cherries or berries or fruits. These are aged, in many cases, 3 years. And quite frankly, America...
Well, I've had some that were 20 years old.
Exactly. But to bring to market... Right, and they can age longer than that. But to bring to market a product that you have to wait so long for in the beer world is almost unheard of in the United States. They have different processes of open fermentation, where you go to breweries, and if you can just vision a tractor in a wheat field outside the brewery, they open the windows, and the dust is the wild live yeast. It is a necessary component ingredient in the brewing process, and that yeast goes in it, and it's open vats, and they ferment the beer in open fermentation, creating some tremendous beers.
Well, let me just bring our listeners up to speed who may not realize just how special this is and how different this is. The way you make a beer is you take a grain that you then the starch comes out of the grain and is converted to sugar and the yeast is introduced, and the yeast basically eats the sugar or the starch and then creates some alcohol and some CO2, which gives you the fizz, and that's a beer. Now, in America, when we brew beer, we take in a very controlled, very sterile environment. I'm talking about the large breweries at the very least, and even many of the microbrews is, or the craft beers, will introduce a specific strain of yeast that we've picked out, or a couple of strains of yeast, to start that fermentation process. In Belgium, what they do with these naturally fermenting beers, they call them, is they allow the ambient yeast in the air, in the dust, floating in the brewery, to just start the process itself. If you go to the supermarket on grapes, if you see that white cloudy stuff on the outside of the powdery stuff on the outside of grapes, that's yeast. And if it's not stopped, the natural yeast, which is much more complex and much more risky...
Well, it's likely yeast, unless people have been spraying stuff all over your grain. Could be something else.
But using natural yeast is very risky. Does the natural yeast... Tell us about why natural yeast is better, and maybe what risks people are taking when using natural yeast.
Well, the first thing is that this brewing process, in the United States would not be permitted, most likely, by the FDA. We're so regulated. Yet this is a style that has been, around, for hundreds and hundreds of years. It becomes a brewing ingredient, part of the process. The yeast that, as I say, you walk into these breweries, and there might even be a trace of dust within the brewery because this process has been done for, such a long time. The styles vary specific to the brewery. They all have their strains of yeast, be it natural or they guard their yeasts. We've been to breweries, converse to that, we've been to breweries where the brewer on the weekends takes a strain of the brewery home for the reason, literally, that in their mind, the brewery, God forbid, could burn down.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is a strain of yeast. And that strain of yeast may be 300 years old,
wow.
200 years old.
And you talk about places or breweries being specific. And there's also, just like French wine, there are some region-specific types of beers that come up.
There are. And, Ale Street News, aside from printing the paper and doing beer events, we conduct travel every year to, what a surprise of all places, Belgium. In fact, we just had a group of 25 of our readers come back. And we tour these breweries. So the breweries themselves are known for, their special recipes. But the most supreme breweries that everyone seems to enjoy are the Trappist monasteries.
I want to talk about Trappist ales and Abbey ales when we come back after the break, because those are really unique and wonderful beers. But before we go to break, though, can you just tell people how they would find out about the event coming up if they want to participate in it?
We'd love for every one of your listeners to participate and come, and they can do that very easily by logging on to www.alestreetnews.com and they can purchase their tickets directly, or they can call us at 1-800-351-ALES, ALES.
And how much are the tickets to this thing?
The tickets are
$98.
$90 plus an $8 service fee, so it's $98 per. Well worth the ticket price. We guarantee it.
And the date?
Is April 10th between 6:30 and 10:30 p.m. So we're about 1 month away. So order now, please.
We're going to put that up on. And I want to go on record as saying the L Street News is not an advertiser on this show. We just really support what they're doing. But we'll put all that information up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. If you missed it, we'll be back in just a moment talking more about beers and ales and monks and monasteries in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:46.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking with Jack Babin. He's one of the founders of the Ale Street News, the nation's largest circulation beer newspaper. We were talking before the break about Belgian beers in particular, and you raised the topic of Trappist ales and Abbey ales. Why don't you tell us about what monks have to do with beer?
Well, the monks really, they get a great deal of credit going back 600-700 years, maybe more. You know, in the medieval days, you know, drinking water was actually an unsafe practice. There could be all kinds of plague and bacteria.
I still feel that way.
So they believed and perfected that it was better to boil your water, and they began creating beer. Not only for the literally the safety of the product, children were drinking beer many years ago for safety reasons. But what they did is also with their fasting and their religious practices, the Belgian monks they're very recluse, but the product, the beers that they produced, are legendary. And to this day, many of them are not available to the public. They have beers that are just for the monks in their religious practices. Some of the beers are very, very drinkable. Some of them, they cannot eat. They have to fast. So they have beers that are literally the equivalent of like a loaf of bread.
Well, I think it's important to tell our listeners, too, that the reason some of those monks look the way they do is because while they're on those fasts, they'll have 3,000 or 4,000 calories a day sometimes of beer. So, you know, that's
true.
Is that really a fast? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
That's more like a slow.
I don't know, but it makes you think about becoming a monk.
Well, now tell us the difference. Now, the Trappist Order of Monks, if they make a beer, that's called a Trappist Ale, right?
Yes.
What's an Abbey Ale?
The Abbey Ales are, you know, it's just a more or less a different version. The monasteries are, you know, producing, you know, some of the greater beers, and the Abbey is just, you know, a different variety, much more drinkable, you know, lighter golden strain, and you know, just it's just a, you know, great product line.
Well, now. So many of these Belgian beers are ageable, quite age-worthy in the bottle. What makes some beers worthy of aging and some beers need born-on dating because if they're a month too old, they've...
Well, really, the lighter the beer, you know, the less that it can tolerate aging. So typically an ale, which is your you know, an ale or, you know, maybe a lager.
And when you say lighter, you're not just talking about color. You're talking about depth of flavor. You're talking about alcohol level. You're
right,
talking about lots
of flavor
things.
And, you know, the alcohol content. You know, as you go into your stronger beers, as you go into your deeper, stronger beers, the India Pale Ale, for instance, was introduced, you know, hundreds of years ago by the British, because a typical ale could not make it around the southern tip of Africa to India. They had to create a stronger beer, and beer can age longer. Mm. And now these Belgian beers are typically 10%, 12%, some of them are 14%. They can age almost forever.
One of the things you need to be careful when you're drinking Belgian beers, now some of them are in the 5 or 6% range, which would be a strong American
beer. Which would be an average Belgian, a light Belgian.
Right, which would be a light Belgian. But many of them, just like you just said, are in the 10, 12, 14. When you're drinking a Belgian beer, you may be drinking the equivalent of two or three American beers. And we need to be careful with that.
An American beer equivalent, very, very commonly, would be like a barley wine.
Mm-hmm.
The barley wines tend to be a heavier grade beer, and they tend to be in the 10%, 10.5% category. That would be very, very common mm-hmm. in a Belgian beer. The Belgians are much stronger beers.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Belgian beers, and I think they are the leaders in the world. I remember years ago, back when we first opened the restaurant, a beer maker by the name of Pierre Celis moved to the United States and was making a beer called Celis White in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And that beer was great for a long time. And then that brewery got sold as well to one of the larger conglomerates. And the struggle to find Belgian-style beers in the United States has become more difficult, less difficult now than it was 10 years ago. There are a few people doing some great things. Can you talk to us about them?
In the United States?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are fantastic brewers throughout the United States. And as a matter of fact, the late Michael Jackson credited that aside from Belgium, the plethora of brewing styles
mm-hmm.
in the United States, is second to none. And we've got very adventurous brewers in the U.S., many young people, you know, looking to come out with new products and new varieties. I would say, you know, Southampton Brewery out mm-hmm. in the Hamptons, Phil Markowski is making some great, great beer products. Many, many different styles, not just from Southampton, but we will have select Belgian-style products.
Great.
At your event as well. Okay, so
perfect.
If they come, you might be surprised at the quality of the wit beers, the wheat beers, and the Belgian styles that will be available at the UBT. And I'm very familiar with Pierre Celis. He opened Hoegaarden, then he came to mm-hmm. the United States, and he's a legend in the Belgian brewing business.
Well, you know, if you want to find out more about beer, there's more information than you could ever want. You should subscribe to the L Street News. If you don't subscribe to it, you really don't know what's going on in the country. You guys do great work out there, and thanks for coming on the show.
I want to thank you both so much, and we'll see you at the UBT.
Hopefully. All right, sounds great.
And you can find out more about the UBT on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You know, over the break, Mark and I were just reminiscing about the first time that I encountered Belgian beer, and I got to tell you when it is. I was already bartending, and the bar we were in introduced this new beer called Chimay,
mm-hmm.
and I'd never seen it before. I was a bartender, and it was when it was first introduced into New Jersey and New York. And it was a full bottle. It was a
750 milliliter. Same size as a bottle of wine.
And you'll find Chimay out there a lot these days. It's quite expensive, but it's quite delicious. Now, when people say Belgian beers are expensive, remember, Belgian beers are 10% alcohol. Your average, you know, bottle of Budweiser is 4.5% alcohol. what that means is you drink less of it. It's not like you're drinking it to get drunk, but it's a lot more concentrated.
But be careful, because there's an expression that's called two Chimay's to the wind.
Yeah. Well, I experienced that firsthand when we were allowed to have a staff drink at the end of our shift. And so it was a Monday night, and I drink beer on a regular basis. I drink wine on a regular basis. I think I'm pretty good at knowing how much I can handle. Well, it was a 750-milliliter beer, so I said to the other person who was working, I said, listen, do you want to share this for our staff drink, which we were allowed to do, rather than, you know, have two smaller beers? And we said, sure. So I'm thinking, you know, half a bottle of beer, 375 milliliters of beer, that's, you know. And I'm cleaning up the bar, and I drank it, I guess, fairly quickly, and I got through it, and I was like, oh, my God.
I can't drive my car.
I wasn't quite there, but I was like, I'm a little tipsy on one beer. What the heck is going on? And then I realized that was my first encounter with Belgian beer.
Look at the back of the bottle. You see it's 9 or 10% alcohol. And that's, you know, it's three times as much as a Budweiser.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had 375 milliliters of beer, which is a little more than a bottle of beer would be. And you had 3.5 bottles of beer.
Right. No, and I had a bottle and a half, a full-size wine bottle and a half full of beer. But I didn't realize it.
Right.
So, you know, you need to be careful out there and you need to be responsible. But the thing is, pick up the L Street News if for nothing else than to find out about their events. A lot of them are local. They're all over the country. And also to find out a beer or two that is age-worthy, that you can put in your basement, and age a case of Chimay for a year or two. And wonderful things happen.
Yeah, it's great. And I do recommend, one of the reasons we have these guys on right now, this Belgian Beer Festival is going to be a lot of fun. And Belgian beers, I think, are the best in the world.
Just like the Restaurant Guys radio show is the best radio show in the world, and you have great taste for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.